This message is part of the educational ministry of Columbia International University. We've been preparing world Christians to know Him and to make Him known since 1923.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Morning. Appreciate you coming out. I had a wonderful drive down here from Raleigh, North Carolina yesterday. And it's my first time on your campus, and it's great to see you here. It's great to be in a place that takes time out in the middle of the day to worship. That doesn't happen much in my office, and doesn't happen much for people that I work with. And it's really, it's terrific. It's terrific. So, sometime after I became a Christian, I discovered I had this condition. And I think the technical term for it is spiritual amnesia. You see, what would happen is that I would wake up in the morning, I'd spend some quiet time, have some prayer time, maybe even listen to Christian music on the way to work in my car. I'd go into work, and then I'd come out of work at the end of the day, and I totally had forgotten I'd been a Christian the whole day. It totally slipped my mind. I was going from meeting to meeting, working on emails, returning contracts, doing business deals together, and I'd get back in the car, and I'd like, how did I forget I was a Christian? And I would try harder the next day, and the same day, the same thing would happen. This amnesia would come over me again, and I would lose track of where I am. Well, I tried some other things. I would write scripture and put it on my computer monitor, or maybe put something on my wrist, and that kind of worked, but really what was happening is I would be taking these spiritual timeouts, where I would be in the middle of, I'd be in the middle of a day, and I look at it, and I say, okay, let me take a minute and read this scripture, and now I'm a Christian, but then the phone rings, and I'm sort of back to my amnesia again. So that didn't work so well either. And this bothered me a lot, because, see, the thing is that I feel like, and have always felt that if the gospel is really in my heart, if this is real for me, more real than anything else in my life, then there should be a differentness to me, right? There should be a differentness to the way I go about everything, and particularly business, because that's where I sort of focus my life. So what should that differentness look like? How should we be different? Well, there are forced and conspicuous differences. And so you can do things where you can stop in the middle of a business meeting and maybe call for prayer among people that don't get why you're doing that. And honestly, if your conscience and God is leading you to do that, that's fine. But that's not, it would have been forced for me. It would not have been authentic for me. And so how was I going to be different? So I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. And ultimately, at one point, a pastor of mine asked me to teach a class on faith in the workplace. And actually, he first asked me to teach a class on workplace evangelism. And I told him that I didn't think I could do that because not enough people had taken the prerequisite. And he said, well, what's that? And I said, workplace Christianity. How could you possibly tell someone to follow you what you're doing if they don't even see you doing it? Right? You have to learn how to behave like a Christian, be different in the workplace for you to be able to lead them in that direction. So he said, okay, we'll teach that, and walked off. So then I had to teach this class. And as I really reflected, how would I teach this class, and reflected more, how do I really solve this problem, or at least have a way of attacking this problem, I found my way to Galatians. Galatians 5:22 and 23 specifically, where Paul talks about the fruit of the Spirit. And he talks about a set of characteristics, of differences. He says the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. At least that's the way I learned it. And these nine things are a set of attitudes, they're a set of attitudes and habits that, when developed, can be practiced authentically in the workplace in a way that makes a difference, in a way that's welcome. And so I can sort of reconcile my workplace self and my spiritual development with my professional development. If I build my professional development, who I'm trying to be as a business person, around the fruit of the Spirit, then all the time I spend in quiet times, all the time I spend in reflection, trying to get better at those things, to reflect them better, I'm actually developing the person I'm trying to be as a professional. Right? So my career is advanced by doing these things. And the point is not to do them to advance my career, that would be wrong. But the point is that you align those things so that you can be the same person the whole time. You see, everyone, at least in business, and I think everywhere, you wind up building a brand for yourself. Right? So some people are known as closers, right? You get them in a deal, they'll find a way to get the deal signed. Some people are rainmakers. You bring them into an office, they find ways to increase your sales. Some people are grumblers. Some people are sort of, you know, some people are downers, right? And they get into a meeting and they just make everyone feel bad about what's going on. Some people are brainstormers. They naturally are creative people. And as they go through work, they start to create this brand for themselves. People start to realize this is who does this in our space. Well, I believe that difference starts to feel like a brand, right? The way that I want to be seen, my brand should be the gospel. There's a book, What Color Is Your Parachute, that talks about sort of how do you market yourself to people when you're looking for a job. It was actually written by a pastor, four pastors who were moving from the ministry into the workplace. And to me, the color of your parachute can be the gospel. Right? And because the things that your brand is an assembly of the fruit of the Spirit. So after teaching the class, I actually got a strong enough response that they encouraged me to take it and make it into a book. So it was never really, I've started several businesses, it was never on my bucket list to make a book. But I felt like what I had, I looked around for a long time figuring somebody else had already done this, and when I couldn't find it, I felt like I had to. So I put this book together called Fruit at Work. There'll be copies in the library, not today, but soon, if you're interested in it. And a lot of what I'm going to talk to you about today is further detailed in that. You can also find it on Amazon and get it on Kindle. And in fact, if you're interested enough, I'll make a copy of it. I'll make an e-copy available. If you have e-readers, you can talk to your dean of students and he'll get you a copy. How about that? Okay, so as I went through the fruit of the Spirit, what I found was that you have these nine things, and the first four are they're attitudes, right? They're things that you're carrying, it adjusts the way that you think about things inside of your head. They're invisible, but they have to feel real to you. And the first one that they get at is love. The first one Paul talks about is love. And a lot of you are in seminary and you know that there's probably different kinds of love. You have phileo and you have eros and you have different kinds of love. And this love, as most of you know, is probably agape. And it's no accident that Paul put love in it as the first thing in the list, because that is the ultimate difference, right? In John, I think it's 17, 16, when he's sort of giving his last advice to the apostles before the cross, he's saying, they will know you're my people by your love, right? That is the difference that will be out there. Because this word agape, it was a kind of love that Jesus didn't invent, but it was a kind of love that the Greeks speculated on. But it was kind of like the unicorn of loves. They had a word for it, but nobody had ever seen it, right? It was this idea that somebody might be loving to somebody whether it helps them or not. See, phileo is like a familial love. I'm sticking up for you because you're my little brother and I have pride in my family, right? Eros, there's a love. I have a romantic attraction to you, right? Agape is, this may hurt me, this may help me. Either way, I'm going to bless you. There's a particular attitude. And the Greeks couldn't figure out how you would do it or why you would ever want to. And then Jesus shows up and he answers the question, right? Because he goes to the cross. He didn't need it. He and the Father had this perfect relationship with each other. He didn't need us. There was no direct benefit to him, yet he saved us. And he saved us in our most ungrateful time, right? He saved us by us killing him, which is like the perfect agape, textbook agape. And so, what Paul is saying is that in terms of this love, that attitude of how can I bless you without an agenda is a way that defines us as believers. Now, doing that in the workplace can be a little bit challenging, but this is what it feels like, at least to me. There's two ways that love fits into the way that I do business strategically. The first is that most of what I do, I manage trust. You see, as an entrepreneur, I've started several companies, and I'm in the middle of starting one now. In fact, I have a board meeting in the morning. And when you start out as an entrepreneur, you're starting out with nothing, except you have some idea in your head, and you're trying to make this idea in your head into something real. In fact, being an entrepreneur is a tremendously spiritual exercise. You kind of feel God's joy of taking something and making it real. It's a wonderful thing. But the first thing I have access to that's semi-real is trust. If I can get the people around me, if I can accumulate enough trust in the people around me, I can trade it for investors, I can trade it for employees, I can get sales, I can get press exposure, I can get strategic deals. All of those things depend on me getting enough trust from the people around me. So if I'm going to be a skilled entrepreneur, I have to make sure there's enough trust there to be able to develop. Well, here's the interesting thing. The people that you trust the most are the people who love you the most. Write them down on a piece of paper sometime, you'll see. The thing is that if you develop this habit, if you develop a reputation for somebody who wants to bless you, whether it's going to work out for them or not, you wind up having this harvest of trust that's around for you when you need it. Right? So you wind up coming up with this benefit. Another way that love plays in is that I write win-win deals. There's some people who go into a deal and they figure, I'm going to get everything I can out of this deal, and anything I left on the table is an underachievement, right? I only win if you lose. And there are very successful business people who work that way. There's an alternate strategy, and the one that I play is to write a win-win deal, which means that I want you to be at least as blessed as I am in this deal. But in order to get that, I have to be a student of what would bless you. Right? I don't try to figure out what kind of deal makes sense until I really understand what you're hoping to get out of your relationship with me. But here's the thing, if I structure it where I make sure that you get that out of it, that deal is going to last for a long time. Right? I don't have to worry about that deal evaporating as soon as you figured out what I did to you in a contract. You know, you write a contract with somebody, the law may force them to do it, but they're going to do everything they can to minimize it and get out of it when they can. You write a deal that blesses them, whether they have to do what they want or not, they're going to keep doing it. So deals that are win-win are more sustainable. And so I find just as a business practice, writing those deals is consistent with this emphasis of learning how to practice love towards the people around me. You see how those fit together? Let's look at a few others. Okay, so joy. Joy is and one of the things that I had to do with this is word by word, I really had to do very detailed word studies. Because some of these words, when you first read them, it's like, what do you mean by joy? And I first looked at the difference between joy and happiness. And they sound like they're kind of synonyms, but they're not at all. Happiness is something that happens within a moment. You can think of a time when you were happy. Joy is like a possession. Once you've experienced joy, you always have it with you, right? It's something that you keep as a possession. I have with me the first moment that my daughter was laid in my arms 18 years ago. I have with me the joy of when I saw my wife from the end of the aisle when I was waiting to get married to her. I have the point where I really felt God's presence, absolutely, undefinably, and just the white hot joy that was in the middle of that, right? And I had those as possessions. So where does that play in the workplace? In every workplace, and I think in every situation, no matter whether in your workplace or anything else, there are going to be times where there's a major setback to a team. Maybe somebody that's like the person on your team you can't do without goes and takes a job somewhere else. Or somebody that you really love on your team wound up getting fired, and you don't know what to do about it. Or your biggest customer, switches over to your competition. And at that point, everybody on the team, their heads are down, they don't know what to do, what are we gonna do now? And they just feel like their world is crumbling around them. If you're a football fan, that's probably what was going on in the Panthers locker room last weekend, right? Is, two close wins, they just couldn't get it done, and nobody wants to make eye contact with each other. As a Christian, as a person of joy, you get to be the first one to shake it off. Because the joy that you have is so much greater than whatever that thing is that everyone thinks is ending their world. Right? I mean, whether it's a football game, or whether it's a deal, or whether it's something your team is working on, or whether it's a job that you're at, it's the pregame. Right? We already know that the important stuff is covered. We already have the important joy. Right? So because you have that context, you get to be the one who can snap out of it and say, look, let's just get back to work. Things are going to get better. I know it looks bad now. And those are people who are really valuable within an organization. The people who can get everybody else back on track. Are the people that are really highly valued and very important to have around. You get to be those people. Peace is another fruit that's an attitude, and it's a contentment with where things are. Jack Welch, who is a CEO of GE and one of the most highly regarded businessmen of the 20th century, he wrote a book where he looked at what qualities he looked for people he was going to put in charge of his divisions. And he talked about this, the kind of guy who didn't get rattled easily. That somebody who had that steady hand on the wheel. And that's what this piece is about. It's a similar thing where because because you have your peace with God to draw upon, you don't have to be rattled by whatever is freaking people out around you at the moment within business. You know, and in fact, I've got in the business I'm in now, I'm actually mentoring a CEO, and we're coming up to what's, you know, potentially a difficult board meeting tomorrow. Not everything that they thought was going to work out at the last meeting had worked out, and we've got to work through it. And I could sit across the table. Thankfully, he's a believer as well. I could sit across the table and I could say, listen, God's peace is available to you for this. You know, just ask, you know, ask for it. God will give you his peace on it. You know, we still have to work through it, but you don't have to be nervous about it. Because we have access to that, right? And that's a powerful asset. So what else do I have in my toolbox? Patience. Patience, this was, I kind of had fun with this because there's two kinds of patience. There's patience with a situation, right? And there's patience with people. So a patience with a situation, you may be in a traffic jam on a highway, nobody's moving anywhere, and you're just frustrated, you wish somebody would move. And that's one kind of patience. The patience that Paul writes about is the patience of people. There's one particular person in front of you on the highway, and if they would just move out of your way, you would be back to being happy again, right? And you're frustrated with them in particular. This is macrothumia, by the way. It sounds like a skin rash or something, which is, you know, and it's almost as painful. But here's the cool thing with patience is I was looking at this word. I came across a quote from Marcus Aurelius, who was a famous Roman statesman. And he said that patience is a brand of justice. And I first read that and it's like, what does he mean by that? And the more I looked at it, the cooler it was, because here's the thing. Part of the reason, and I think what really gets under my skin in terms of patience, the person that annoys me, is that they don't even know what they're doing. Right? They're getting away with it. It's not just that they annoyed me, it's the injustice of it. They don't realize how messy they left the counter after they went to school that morning. They don't realize that they didn't put paper back in the copier and now I have to do it. They don't realize that they're talking on their cell phone going 5 miles under the speed limit in the fast lane. Right? And so it's not just that they're doing it, but they don't know that they're doing it. Right? Justice is not being served. Well, there's two ways that justice could be served, right? One is that the person who's leaving, you know, the kitchen a mess on the way out to school gets hit in the back of the head with a wet washcloth, and that would serve them right, right? But the other kind of justice is for somebody to say, you know, I probably did something to annoy them yesterday. I'm going to forgive them, right? That justice is also served by forgiveness. We know that, you know, we know that from God's forgiveness, right? Justice was served not by us paying the penalty. Justice was served by somebody else absorbing the penalty. So patience, it's kind of like junior varsity grace, right? It's the stuff that we get to practice that makes us feel like what God does, makes us feel closer to Him. We're doing what we see Him do, right? Just on a regular day-to-day basis. It was the way Marcus Aurelius finished it is he says, because all of us sin without intending it, right? We all go through life offending other people. So in a workplace, what does this mean? Well, a workplace, if you think about it like an engine, everybody has to work together, it's like gears running together. If you don't have patience, it's like letting all the oil run out of the engine. In theory, these gears still fit together, but if you ever try to do it, what happens is the friction builds up, they overheat, and they lock up together, and you just have one solid engine block. Same thing happens at work. If you have a work full of people that are frustrated with each other, they get so distracted by how they're frustrated with each other that nothing happens, and the office locks up. Patience is the grease in those gears. So by being an example of that patience, you actually help your office, your environment, whatever work group you have, work together smoothly. Right? And that's a difference. So looking at some of the attitudes, and for some of this, I'm not going to be able to go through all of the fruit, but just, you know, kindness is that active love. It's the little things and sometimes the great things that you do for people around you that help them to be able to feel this attitude of love. Goodness is different from kindness in that it's actually, what I found was that it was a pursuit of a moral good. It's the kind of goodness that, there's an auto dealer in Winston-Salem named Don Flo. And what he discovered was that when you were, when he was selling his cars, women were paying about $2,000 more per car than men were. And some of you may have already figured out why, but what it comes down to is that men haggle much more than women do over cars. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. There was nothing illegal about his car business. But he morally felt that there was something unjust about that, and he changed his policy to a no-haggle policy so that there was not essentially a $2,000 tax on his women customers for not being hagglers. So, you know, he made that adjustment, and that's the kind of goodness. And the thing is that you can build that brand. There's a fella that I met up in New York who's part of Jay-Z's organization. And he has clothing lines and liquor, JD does, and liquor lines and TV and music and everything else. This guy has become known, you know, he's a known believer within an organization. And when they have meetings, and there's sort of this implicit moral question, right? Are we crossing the line on this idea? They all sort of turn around and look at him to see whether he thinks they are or not, right? He didn't buck up for that job, but just because that's his brand, he became that within that organization. And our culture is better for it, to some degree. And I'll talk about one more of the fruit, and that's the fruit of gentleness. As you grow to positions of leadership, it becomes more difficult to get people to tell you when you're wrong, because they're afraid you're just going to take it out on them if you do. And if you're able to cultivate this attitude of gentleness, which comes from humility, right? It's part of this daily walk that we're in the middle of. You get to hear when you're on the wrong track from people who can see it better than you do. And you save so much time and money and trouble and frustration over that if you can master that. So all of these fruit wind up being a group of resources that you can practice in an authentic way as a believer. So what do some of those differences look like? Or what would they sound like? You know, a Christian difference. If love is practiced by somebody in an office, you might hear, you know, out of everyone in the office, Holly was the only one who remembered today was the anniversary of the day I lost my mom. Joy. Have you noticed how nothing really gets Lee down? Even after his team lost that big deal, he was able to get them out of their funk and in the game the next day. Faithfulness. We have a serious problem, but if we ask the wrong person to handle it, I'm afraid they're just going to go looking for another job instead of helping us. I know we can trust Spencer to see it through. Kindness. You know how Carly got her meeting with a buyer? One day she noticed someone trying to get several boxes to their office from the curb, and she stopped to help. It turns out the guy she helped was the buyer's secretary. All these things fit together in a way that create an authentic way of pursuing career. So some of you, this hopefully relates directly to, you're imagining yourself in the workplace. Others of you are going to be pastors. And I wanted to talk to you about this, and pastors and people in that line, because this is very important. I've done this book often enough. I talk to a number of pastors, and I hear something very common. They say, you know, a couple of years ago, I did a talk about, I did a sermon series about workplace issues, and you know, I would give myself maybe a C+, B- on it. It was nowhere near my best sermon, but I got 5 times more emails and responses on that than anything I've done since. You know, what they're finding is that the people that they're speaking to, their congregation, they want what they're learning to be relevant in the workplace. If this is real, it needs to be real in all parts of their life, and it's the part they're not hearing much about. And it makes sense why they're not hearing it much. I mean, the thing is that it's an awkward place for a minister or a pastor to get to, either in a one-to-one conversation or a ministry. Think about it. I mean, you're trained here a lot, I think, on how to handle if my child has run away from home, or if I have a spouse that's left me, or if I'm grieving over the loss of a loved one, or if I'm struggling with whether to believe in God or not. All those things, you're ready for that, right? Somebody walks into the office, you got your plan, or at least you should, right? You have some level of confidence, they're going to come out, you know, you're going to feel like you did a decent job with it. Somebody comes in and says, you know, I got this guy Frank, and he's not performing well enough for me to keep him. But I know that if he loses his job, he's going to lose his house. And I just don't have the heart to do it. What's the right thing to do? Right? You don't necessarily, I don't think you've been trained. I haven't been trained how to answer that question right. Right? You have to, I think the best answer is, I'm not sure what the answer is, but let's walk through this together and see what the Word can tell us. It demands a humility. It demands a willingness to go into topics where you don't have the same confidence that you're going to come out with the right answer. But it is what the people around you need to know. It is a worthy pursuit. There are places with theology of work. What I tried to model for you today is some ways to look at it. Here's what, and just in terms of that question, here's a way that I found that I looked at it. There's a certain line where I cannot make myself responsible for the lives of everyone working for me to work out. If I do that, I'm essentially making myself into God for them. And I'm robbing them of the dignity of making adult decisions. Right? What I can do, and the right thing to do, is if when somebody comes, there was a guy who came to me for a job. And we, through the interview process, I asked if they had any questions, and they said, well, how do I know that you're not going to sell the company next week, and I'm going to be, you know, and I won't have a job? And I said, to be honest with you, you don't. And if my next meeting was about selling the company, I could not and would not tell you. Because that's the nature of this business. And if that's not a situation that you can handle, then you shouldn't come here. But let me tell you why, you know, let me tell you why I think this is a good place to come. Let me give you the arguments for. But I need to give you everything you need to know so that you can make an adult decision. Because if I have to sell the company, I don't want to worry about whether you're going to come back saying, look what you did to me. Because what you did was you made an adult decision based upon the best information I could give you. Right? And it's this trade-off. You want to sort of take care of everybody, but you can't. What you can do is you can give them the dignity of being able to make decisions in a context that's balanced. So, you know, I have conversations with people about a lot of these things. It can be sorted out. But it is something that has to be thought through. But I think in doing it, you sort of model that difference. You model that realness of the gospel in every aspect. Well, I thank you very much for your time today. Hopefully something came out of this. If you're more interested, take advantage of reading through the book. I think I've pulled these pieces apart and will give you more to think about. Thank you.
We hope you were blessed by this message. Additional audio messages and learning resources are available at www.ciu.edu/bookstore or call 803-807-5263. Messages are also available by podcast at iTunes. CIU is a regionally accredited biblical university offering undergraduate and graduate degree programs. Our purpose is to educate people from a biblical worldview to impact the nations with the message of Christ. Thank you for letting us minister to you today.